finished the joint and the Heineken. Then I put a blanket over her and stood there, hands in my overcoat pockets. I considered taking the blanket off. I took the blanket off. Then I lifted her arm and looked at her breasts. Touched them. Maybe I'll ravish her, I pondered. But it was getting close to 4 and I had a class in 6 hours, though the prospect of going seemed fairly remote. On the way out, I stole her copy of 100 Years of Solitude and turned her stereo off and left. Pleased and maybe a little embarrassed. I was a senior. She was a nice girl. She ended up telling everyone I couldn't get it up anyway. So writes Bret Easton Ellis in The Rules of Attraction, which we're discussing as part of the broader collected works of Bret Easton Ellis here on Literary Guys. I'm Dr. Gordon McCallan.
And I'm author Zachary Kelly, and we're also going to be talking a little bit about Lunar Park, Imperial Bedrooms, Glamorama, just kind of talking about the rest of this man's body of work and kind of how it ties into the broader cultural landscape that he has both been influenced by and I think to a certain degree has influenced.
I mean, you can be guaranteed if you pick up any of his books, you will be saddened by the end of it.
Yeah. This man has a very bleak outlook on humanity, and no one escapes these novels unscathed.
They all start off with characters who should be happy, and I feel like that's what ties them all together. There's no reason why, if the characters in these books took a lot of therapy and focused on not being selfish, but focused on themselves and what they wanted, might actually be happy. But not only are the main characters unable to do that, no one around them is either. They never have any good influences in their lives.
The only thing that seems to separate maybe our protagonists in these novels from the other equally vapid, solipsistic, empty characters is a minor degree of self-awareness, not enough to actually escape this situation.
Oh, no. But I seem to remember no escape, or is it no exit?
This is not an exit, or in the case, as referenced in American Psycho, or in the case of Less Than Zero, disappear here.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
There are just so many instances of just this void of humanity that people are falling into. And I think you're right. It is all coming from this, like, privileged point where, man, all the things that we strive for in the United States, all those materialistic and societal ideas of felicity that we cling to and are part of this rat race for, these people already have, and they've had since the very beginning, and it brings them no happiness and no joy, and in fact really contributes to their downfall in every single one of his novels. And it is a very interesting, I think very American look at society that few others than Ellis can capture so perfectly.
What do you think that Bret Easton Ellis would have to say with the current bro culture of the mega billionaires who seem to be very much in the Twitter sphere these days?
Yeah, it's interesting. We don't have a novel yet from Ellis that is about social media. He's got something about Wall Street. He's got something about models and celebrity culture. And I think that probably would be the next step for him, is to talk about the complete emptiness of the metaverse and the social media world. I think he is very unsurprised by the rise to power, if you will, of the Elon Musks of the world. I think it all makes sense to him in ways it was predicted by him, and sadly, I think reinforces what is a very sad worldview that he has often written about.
I think one of the elements that really jumps out at me about these books is, in some ways, they're about the 80s, and we talked about in the Less Than Zero episode about how he, as an author, doesn't really like these books being looked at as a nostalgia.
Yeah.
But I would, in some ways, agree that these books are just about male society in a way that is a little bit timeless. I don't think that any of these struggles that we see in these books has really changed that much.
I agree. And I think the cultural touchstones that he puts, both from the 80s and in cases of like Glamorama from the 90s, where it is, you know, basically just name-dropping. In Glamorama, there's whole paragraphs that just list the name of celebrities without any, like, verbs or adjectives. It is reinforcing, again, that empty worldview that we've kind of discussed. And I think what has made it so easily misinterpreted as nostalgia or, you know, the soundtrack of our lives and all this stuff. And I think people who feel that way about his work are very much missing the point, and I can understand why that enrages him so much.
So one of the things that had come to mind as we were considering this Bret Easton Ellis month was the fact that we've talked about another author mm-hmm. who has some similar themes and seems to be railing in many ways against the same misogynistic views of society. And that's Chuck Palahniuk.
Right.
And I think it'd be good for a few minutes just to kind of dig into the similarities and differences there.
And the similarities are many. It is fascinating to me that we've got these two juggernauts of the American literary scene who, for much of their career, wrote very disparagingly about heteronormative masculine culture, really kind of peeling back the curtain of heteronormative masculine culture, and then later in life came out as gay men. And the similarities in both their themes and in the height of their successes is fascinating. I do think we're dealing with two very different men, despite the fact that on the surface you could easily confuse some of their stylings for one another. For me, and we've been really excited to talk about this, we've actually avoided talking about this with each other because I think we just wanted to dive into it for a few minutes on the podcast, the pod, if you will, mm-hmm. as some people are calling it these days, is really where their lives started, I think. You've got Bret Easton Ellis, who we've already touched upon, came from a very privileged background, very Ivy League adjacent education, all of that stuff. And Chuck Palahniuk, who came from a very lower middle class city here in Washington State and has kind of been struggling upwards throughout his career. And I think that that's the difference. If you compare like American Psycho and Fight Club, their seminal works, you very much on the surface have reality is not as it appears and hyper-masculinity kind of taking hold and atrocious acts being a result of that hyper-masculinity. But in the case of American Psycho, you're dealing with a very privileged set of society. In Fight Club, they're at least punching up while...
So to speak.
Yeah. Their actions are no less reprehensible. The outcomes are no less dire, but you can at least feel the struggle of the working class trying to make its own mark in society, where so much of Ellis's work is the working class, if mentioned, is but a derogatory afterthought. And it is really the plight of the privilege that we're constantly forced to exist in. And I don't think that makes it any less artistically meritful, but it is an interesting contrast in their dynamics.
So the way I look at the two is that as a basis, I think that they are very similar, as you point out. We're touching on common themes. We're touching on a lot of the same motivations. But I feel when I read their works that there is one defining way in which they're different, which is with Chuck Palahniuk, I feel like the frustration comes out in the form of anger. Mm. And with Bret Easton Ellis, the frustration comes out in ennui.
Mm-hmm.
That there's this sense with Palahniuk that you need to do something. You need to take action. You need to channel your anger into some sort of other venue, other mechanism in order to actually accomplish something, in order to make yourself better, or at least to make that underlying anger go away. Whereas with Bret Easton Ellis, we're in this like burnout of dopamine that leads to this general sense of ennui that is inescapable. And no matter what his characters do, they never break free from that lack of sensation that has been instilled at a young age due to having nothing ever really withheld from those characters in their lives.
It's a really interesting take. And I think looking back at our previous season when we did Fight Club, I think I have a good example of where those differences kind of land.
Go for it.
We just did last week an episode of American Psycho, and it is unrelentingly violent. At points, disarmingly so, to the point where I didn't read whole chapters again because I just didn't want to put myself through that. But it's so antiseptic, mm-hmm. it's tough to draw any emotion from it. To your point, the dopamine is gone. If I recall, there's a character, I believe his name was Angel in Fight Club, who through his desire to be loved by Tyler Durden and embraced by this world, takes these awful beatings time and time again.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall you being deeply moved by that, upset by it, riled up by it. Those chapters in Fight Club, I think, disturbed you in some ways more than, and myself included, I would agree with this, myself included, than in American Psycho, because American Psycho is so removed from its own violence, whereas Polonnek in Fight Club is so immediate with the violence and emotional with the violence.
And I think that anger and violence are deeply connected with each other. Mm-hmm. That this isn't sort of a, I hate to say like Dexter-esque, like serial killer kind of violence, which is very much about the method and the mechanism and very specifically how things are done in a pristine, clear way. Now, this is about angry, messy violence.
It makes me wonder, too, you know, using these two authors as examples, specifically because I think we can both agree they're extremely talented writers.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they would have to acknowledge, and certainly we as a discerning public can acknowledge, they like the shock value. They like to push things to the extreme.
They're provocateurs.
Yeah. Reading American Psycho, reading Fight Club, anyone who has been taught critical thinking, who, you know, reads a few novels a year, can recognize these as satires.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we've also seen, definitely with Fight Club, and even to a certain degree with American Psycho, people who don't understand the satire, and they almost admire and idolize, at least, if not the characters themselves, the world that these authors have created, this hyper-masculine world where men are fighting back against woke culture and against feminism and, mm-hmm. you know, against integration and equity and all of that stuff. And I'm wondering if there's a worthwhile conversation to have about where the author's responsibility lies there in recognizing that you are weaponizing words in a way that some people might not understand the meaning of.
Well, I hate to introduce a third novel into this discussion.
Love it.
But since it was earlier this season, let's talk about Lolita.
Yeah.
Lolita, which, as you said, was originally published by someone who thought that this was pornography.
Yeah.
Like, where's the responsibility there?
Mm-hmm.
That we've got these novelists who are writing just incredibly influential works. We've got American Psycho. We've got Fight Club. We've got Lolita. I don't think those three books have ever been mentioned in the same sentence before, but we're just going to go with that. That I think it is the author's responsibility to speak truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there is a line of irresponsibility. Like, if any of these characters were actually portrayed in a positive way in these books, I think that would be different. But sad to say that literature is very much an art form for people who choose to go to books. And I don't worry so much about the book. I don't worry about this being published on ink, on paper.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that makes sense. I actually worry more about the film adaptations of these things, because I think that's where people get into trouble.
And it is very much the film adaptations, to your point, that I think have created a bit of that culture of misunderstanding. You know, whether it be fintech bros comparing business cards in homage to the movie American Psycho, or, you know, every frat guy you knew in college having a Fight Club poster in their room, or even any film or miniseries adaptation of Lolita where you actually can't film it without sexualizing a 12-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. I think it makes maybe a more interesting case of things that should remain books and maybe not be turned into film. Probably a discussion for another time, but I agree with your point that it is the medium that really probably makes the difference there in terms of how the message is received.
Well, you read far more books than I do. Can you think of another book which has not been made into a movie that you believe that would be sensationalized in that way were it to be made into a movie?
Yeah, just right off the top of my head, it's a book that we've talked about doing on this podcast, and we're almost going to do it in December, and that's Blood Meridian, or An Evening's Redness in the West by Cormac McCarthy.
Interesting. It's a really interesting observation.
That is a movie that Hollywood has tried to make time and time and time again, and actually its author has been the one to put a hold on it time and time again, because you really can't put a movie out like that without just the violence that is inherent in those pages that you cannot put on screen as poetically as the written word can. And you cannot create the nuance of character that all these awful men who are essentially murdering and slaughtering Native Americans throughout Mexico Yeah, I think it would be irresponsible to do Blood Meridian as a movie. As much as I kind of want to see someone tackle it and see the chaos that would ensue from that, I think that's, to me, a great example of something that it is so raw and so easy to misinterpret that we didn't even want to tackle it for the podcast because we didn't want to put ourselves through. We didn't trust ourselves to parse out the nuance as much as the author probably intended it to be.
I think it's a really good example. I feel like we are in this world right now where there's so much of a pressure with all of the big media companies is trying to make so much content.
Yeah.
That sense of responsibility is diminished.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly with the, as we talked about in the previous episode, the long form drama now, which is opening up the gateway to many books which were difficult to adapt in the past. Now we have a venue for that. But I think that this is a real challenge because there are certainly things that are beautiful worlds that have terrible things happening, which I think Brett Easton Ellis does a great job of. And I feel like those could go wrong very quickly in this context that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is, I think, something we're always going to struggle with when it comes to art and culture. And I hope we continue to struggle with it because I think one of the things we risk losing in society today is not wanting art that challenges us, not wanting art that provokes us. I hope that we always have that. I hope we always have authors like Brett Easton Ellis, who you and I can both love and kind of dislike at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think that that is so important in art. And, you know, I just hope that we as a progressive society don't lose that, because I think we lose something of ourselves if we do.
And I think that's part of Brett Easton Ellis' critique of wokeness, is that there is a lack of interest in perhaps learning something through being offended.
Yes.
He is very much about driving home a point by offending through the complete opposite of the point which he's trying to make.
And I think on that we can agree with Brett Easton Ellis, and then on basically everything else we can feel free to disagree with him on.
I think that's a great point to wrap things up here.
Speaking of ugly worlds rendered beautifully, our reader's choice for next month is going to be a Netflix original, All Quiet on the Western Front, which is being adapted once again. I think it was an Oscar-winning movie back in the 30s, but it's nice to see that it's coming back to a more long-form format. And I really look forward to both comparing that with whatever Netflix rolls out for us, and then going over the novel with you, which I don't think I've read since high school. I don't really remember much about it, so I'm really excited that our readers have kind of brought another war novel to the forefront, because there's going to be some great discussions had there.
I'd never read it before, so I'm really interested in sharing my initial impressions here on the podcast. The Pod, as we've now established it to be called. I'd like to ask, if you haven't already, please like this podcast on your favorite podcast service and leave us a review too. All these things help. I'd really love to hear folks' thoughts as well about Brett Easton Ellis.
Yeah.
In our various options to contact us, we have Zach.
You can reach out to us, litguys@gmail.com. You can go to our website, literaryguys.com. We're all across social media at litguys. We really want to have this dialogue and conversation with you, because we did not pick Brett Easton Ellis because it would be an easy person to discuss. We picked him specifically because it would be a very divisive person. And we want to have those discussions with you, because I think as men, the more discussions we have like that, the more we can grow as individuals, and is why art should be provocative and it should be challenging.
And I would certainly agree that I think Brett as an author is one of the most troubling looks into masculinity, and one that we should all spend some time considering what he has to say, even if it may be upsetting to do so. So until next time, this has been Literary Guys, signing off.